Using my GI Bill taught me I can do anything. And seeing me graduate taught my daughter she can too. VA benefits cover tuition, housing, and supplies. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight.
I'm a crazy host in a crazy world, life in plastic. It's fantastic. Yes, yes. I basically quoted Aqua and the song Barbie Girl, which came out in 1997. No, this is not a nostalgia trip, but today is a little bit different here on Whimsical Wavelengths. Today, I have a guest who's going to be talking all about plastic. And when that came into being, for whatever reason, Aqua's Barbie Girl is the first thing that came to mind. But today, this episode isn't so much based on a paper like what I normally do. Perhaps a bit of a sausage making of the podcast first. I try to cast a wide net to get guests. Blue sky, friends of friends, or colleagues of past guests, cold call emails. I've also used a media platform that helps to line up experts to media sources from time to time. Thus far, I've had two guests. Today will be the third that have come from that method. And so far, it's been great. The big thing with it is that it is PR driven. Guests are coming with a message or a business to advertise or to represent an institution. All of these things are not a problem for Whimsical Wavelengths, as it is a science podcast. And if it's science, it has repeatable data, and that's what really matters. The whole idea of having industry scientists or scientists with a message is a topic that has been tackled from time to time here on Whimsical Wavelengths in some solo episodes, especially with reference to the rise of leaded gasoline and Thomas Midgley. So, plastic. The first fully synthetic plastic was developed back in 1907. What they needed was an electrical insulator, thanks to alternating current. Also covered in season one with Nikola Tesla. So, alternating current, electricity. It was being wired to all kinds of new places, creating a problem of how to insulate these wires. With the success of developing a plastic to do just that, companies began to research and explore what other plastics could be made. World War II created demand for synthetic substitutes for just about everything. Because resources were scarce. We needed things at scale, and plastic could do that. Shortly after World War II, some thought of plastic and created an almost utopian vision of the future, with abundant material wealth thanks to an inexpensive and safe sanitary substance that could be shaped into basically anything. Oh, how those visionaries would be so disappointed with today. The 1960s brought about environmentalism, with plastic debris starting to collect on beaches, the sea, and the environment. The 1970s saw leaded gasoline come to its final phase-out plan. CFCs were next. But plastic has stayed. Sure, there's been some regulatory push against plastic, particularly more recently. Canada, where I'm from, for new listeners, we've banned single-use plastics, including checkout bags, cutlery, food service ware, all made from, quote, problematic plastics, like ring carriers, stir sticks, and all the like. Even the FDA in the recent past has removed a chemical from drinking plastics used by kids. Recycling of plastic has also greatly increased over time, although sometimes with mixed results. Plastic creation and waste is also reaching new levels. We're starting to find and monitor this pollution everywhere. The water, the land, the air. Listeners are probably aware of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch in the Pacific Ocean. I also bet you see plastic coming ashore on local beaches and have heard about other possible environmental and health effects from plastic. At this point, much of the data is actually nuanced. But there are clearly a lot of problems with how much is ending up in the environment. Although, and this is important, that could be said about a lot of things, including carbon dioxide. An interesting guest will join the discussion in just a moment, and this intro is a bit longer than most, but the topic needs a bit more framing. With all the new technology and movement forward, plastic has been an enabler. Material science is huge, and something as simple as vaccine distribution in a global pandemic would have been nearly impossible at the scale it was needed without plastic. Our technological world truly requires it. Circuit boards, clothing, vehicles, personal protective equipment like helmets, and the like. And of course, I've already mentioned wire insulation. Some things, given our consumption habits, are just not possible without plastic. It's here to stay. And it's important to recognize that I write these intros before I interview guests. And the guest gets to read them in full, as a draft. I've never read the same thing the same way twice for the podcast, and ad-libbing new phrases and wordings kind of helps it make it seem a bit more natural. Although they get to see and read this whole intro beforehand, I still reserve the right to change the intro. And I haven't had to drastically change the intro yet. Today is no different. However, I feel I failed at digging into more of the nuance in the discussion about plastic and plastic pollution. I'll try to address this at the end of the discussion instead of here. Today's guest has published books and has made the podcast circuit to bring to light that plastic is not necessarily an enemy.
Today's guest got his PhD from the University of Sussex back in 1993 and spent the last 22 or so years in a variety of different positions in industry, solving scientific problems and marketing. Since 2016, at least according to my research via LinkedIn, he's been flying solo as an independent consultant. So please welcome Dr. Chris Darnett.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, awesome. Before we jump into the main topics, this is a science podcast after all, and you have an academic background. So let's try your PhD first, back in 1993. What was it and how did that lead to your career in science?
Yeah, well, it all began when Norman Billingham, Professor Norman Billingham, who's really a legend in polymer degradation, he sat me down with a bottle of cider. It was a 2-liter bottle. I still remember it because there was only two times in our undergraduate when we would get free alcohol. So he sat me down in the beginning of my chemistry degree and said, this is why you should study polymers, because about a third of chemists end up working with polymers, but only a very small percentage are actually trained in it. So he said there's always more demand than supply, and that's a good place to be. So, and plus he had the alcohol right, so he was convincing. And he was right. It turned out to be really fascinating. He was a genius teacher, and he's one of the reasons I'm able to do what I do, that he showed how simple science can be if you really understand it yourself, how much fun you can make it, and how simple it is to explain. So that's where it all started. And then my PhD came on from that. He also helped me get industrial sponsorship so that I could afford to do my PhD and so forth. And that was on electrically conducting polymer colloids, so dispersions of polyaniline and polypyrrole. Most people think of plastics as insulators, but you can actually get ones that conduct electricity too.
Sure. Maybe we'll pause there and go, wait, you just used a bunch of words. I don't know what they mean. For the different polymers.
Polyaniline and polypyrrole. Those are the electrically conducting polymers. Yeah. There are some other ones too, but that's what my PhD was on, making those.
So can you use those as like a resistor instead of carbon?
Yeah, you can. And you can use them in batteries and so forth. The thing is, most of them are not very stable because they have a lot of double bonds in them. So they're very sensitive to oxidation. And the one that's probably the most stable is polyaniline. And that one is much more applicable. But still, it hasn't really taken off like people hoped it would because other things are cheaper.
Okay, so then how did you, like, it was just your industry contacts through the PhD that kind of springboarded the rest of your career?
Well, they actually promised to fund me and then hire me at the end of it because there was a recession going on. So they said, look, we'll fund you to do a PhD. At the end of it, you can pop out because we don't have any jobs now. At the end of it, you can pop out and we'll hire you. And then they didn't. So I ended up going into some other industry. And it just, you know how careers are. They're not really planned. They just go where you're interested and where the opportunities are. Or in my case, where your girlfriend is half the time. So I kept ending up in relationships with like a girl in Sweden. So I moved to Sweden for 9 years, for example. So just no real plan.
The winds of change, for sure. So I didn't look into every appearance that you've made via media and podcasts. Your bio lists BBC, the 60 Minutes, and a few others. I've also listened to a couple of podcasts you were a guest on. It seems like there are quite a lot of them. Is this the first science podcast you've been on?
I was thinking about that, and I think it is. The other ones have just been general. And as you said, I've done a bunch of those. But this is really the first science one, so thanks for the opportunity to talk to a scientist.
Oh, absolutely. Hopefully I have harder questions.
I hope so, too.
Okay, so it shouldn't be a surprise that this episode is all about plastics. I mean, we have you on. Perhaps we'll get into the good, the bad, and hopefully some nuance as well. Maybe the best place to start is the intro. As you'll hear, the rest of you listeners, that I write the intro, I give it to the guest ahead of time, kind of a check on myself, so to speak. So in that regard, is there anything that needs more context or fact-checking before we get into it?
No, I don't think so. We'll get into the facts and the context. And those are the two main things, not just having facts, but putting everything in perspective. So I think you're right on the correct track there when it comes to plastics. We need to look at what's true, what isn't true, and then put it in context relative to other things that we have on the table, different options.
Nice. So from the 90s to today, spanning your whole career, lots have changed. A lot more so than just my childhood becoming vintage. The point is the world has changed, and I can only assume the same is true for plastic production and use of it as well. So is there like some way to summarize what's really changed over the course of your career?
I would say the biggest changes I've seen are just in efficiency. So the layperson doesn't really understand how much time and effort goes into making things cheaper and achieving the same goal with less material. And if you look at PET, a 500 ml PET bottle, for example, that used to be like 22, 25 grams. And now the record is 8 grams. So people don't realize we're making the same things with a third as much material, which of course is good for our pocketbook and it's good for our environment as well, because the less material you need to use, the better things turn out to be, the more efficient you are. So that's going on behind the scenes, partly for cost reasons, but also partly for environmental reasons. So there are steady improvements going on all the time, even without any environmental mention or push. That's been happening for decades. That's probably the biggest single change I've seen. Also, the increased use of it in automotives, that's been really a big trend, that they use more and more plastic. And that allows them to make, of course, the cars get lighter, and that means we can afford to, because we save weight, now we can put in our GPS and all of our gadgets and the stuff that we want without ruining the miles per gallon. So that's been a big thing as well, the adoption of more plastics in planes and cars and so forth, which, of course, saves fossil fuel when you do the calculations.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned PET. I know it as the plastic that all our plastic bottles are made out of. Is there anything else it's used for?
Yeah, it's used for... the main things that PET is used for is polyester clothing. So when you hear polyester in clothing, that's also PET. So you can take a bottle, you can use it, which is also the lowest impact solution. If you look at a life cycle study, it has the least energy and so forth. So you can take that bottle, you can use it, it's the best option. You can recycle it 10 times, which people don't think you can do with plastic. They assume you can only recycle it once or twice, but you can recycle PET 10 times. That's a peer-reviewed study. Everything I say is peer-reviewed, and I cite the studies verbatim. And then at the end of that time, you can no longer make a bottle because the polymer chains have been shortened too much. And now you can still make polyester clothing with it. So even after you've made a bottle 10 times, you can still make clothing that will then last you another 10 years. So it's pretty cool that way.
Yeah, I think we'll get back to the recycling whole side of things in a little bit. Now, this is a bit outside of my normal formula, because normally I ask for a scientific paper, something to frame the episode around to create a kind of a clear story. It's also really nice to use verifiable articles that have gone through the peer review process. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I was offered the chance to have you on as a guest and saw the initial takeaway messaging and was like, huh, what? And to be fair, not in an entirely a good way. And I have this all the time. I'm a volcanologist, so I'll see an article headline about Yellowstone and I go, oh my goodness, what the heck is this? And then I read the article and the article's fine. Like the underlying science, I could quibble, I could whatever, but underlying it, you're like, okay, fine, no big deal, but why the headline? And I kind of got the same reaction when take a lot of your big takeaway stuff where it's like a clickbait headline. So is that a kind of a surprising thing to you?
Not really. I mean, they've done studies, and no matter how high your IQ is, if you hear a lie...
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Winter Sale and get 30% off paints and stains January 9th through the 19th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Enough times you believe it. So even IQ doesn't defend you against this, and politicians do it to us all the time, and we see it online, we see things in the media, so we already have preconceived ideas, and it's very hard to push back against that because it generates cognitive dissonance, right? If you see the evidence, no matter how overwhelmingly convincing it is, and you've already got something in your brain, it is hard to overcome that. But you made a point about peer-reviewed studies, and that's the basis of all my work. I've read 5,000 of them unfunded because I care about truth. My own daughters were lied to at school. So let me frame, as you just said, and not only that, I read the 5,000 studies, then I wrote 2 books, which I give away for free, and then I sent them to professors all around the world who I don't even know, right, to check it. So if I was a charlatan, I would be shamed by now. I would have been outed as a fraud years ago for shaming nonsense. But these professors endorsed my book willingly without payment, right? So it's all true, and nobody's found any errors in 5 years. But let me frame it as you just. So what I'm trying to say is, everything I'm saying is peer-reviewed. It's not from me. And even my book review is peer-reviewed as well by top professors. And if you were to summarize it, to give that frame you just asked for, it would be that plastic is 0.5% of all materials we use, and it has least impact 9 times out of 10. So, and not to say it doesn't have any impact, and not to say we don't use a lot of plastics, we do. But that's the perspective you were talking about. We need to say, a bit like what... what's that thing that Winston Churchill said, that democracy is the worst form of government apart from all the other ones we've tried? It's a bit the same as plastic. Plastic is the worst material apart from all the other ones that we've looked at. So it does have an impact. It could be better, but it's not the demon that we're led to believe.
Right. So part of this process for myself is, before reading your books, I went to the peer-reviewed journals and tried to arm myself with a little bit of knowledge before diving into them and actually reading them. Although there are some specific examples we can perhaps get into, nothing I read in the peer-reviewed literature really changed my priors. And then I got to the books, and once I got past the initial first paragraph prose, I was like, this is all agreeing to everything that I already had as a prior and what was there. So I was just kind of, I'm still surprised that I still have... a gut check from the window dressing of the message. And maybe that's just because I'm a scientist. That's because I'm not used to interacting with the everyday person on the street. I don't know. Like, is that something on me as a podcaster that I'm doing a poor job of, that I'm not able to connect to people? Because there's obviously something you're doing. You're getting onto these shows and other things. Am I being too wishy-washy in my academic persuasion?
Well, to be honest, I'm not good at it either. I'm a crusader for truth. My daughters were lied to at school, and that made me angry. And so I'm out here, and my message, to be honest, is only resonating with logical people who really care about truth. And that's only 5% of the people. So to be honest, I suffer from the same thing you do. I'm able to take the science. I'm able to distill it down. I'm able to make analogies that get through to some people. But to be perfectly honest, I will never win this fight. I'm up against people with millions in funding, with professional marketers who show you sad pictures of polar bears or some nonsense that doesn't, you know, something that doesn't even exist, like a floating island the size of Texas that isn't there. So I suffer from the exact same thing. I am good at making analogies. I am good at simplifying it. But at the end of the day, most people just love to hate on something without any evidence. And they're too lazy to even glance at evidence. So I have to applaud you for doing it, you know, to looking, instead of having that first allergic reaction to this can't be true, to looking a bit below the surface. And, you know, I cite these studies verbatim. There's like 200 links on the website where you can go and check it yourself. So it's everything checks out. If it hadn't done, somebody would have said something over the last 5 years. So I suffer from the exact same thing. And also, I don't have the budget. People say, why don't you get on Joe Rogan? And I'm like, well, great. You helped me get on Joe Rogan. I don't know Joe Rogan, right? Or get on a TED Talk. It's like, and I apply and they say no. So I'm in this weird position that I'm doing something because I believe truth means something. I know I'm going to fail, but as a scientist, our job is not to advocate for any one material. Our job is to share the science so that people who are logical and people who genuinely care have a place where they can find accurate information. And if you ask me, would you take a PET bottle or a metal can? I'd take the metal can or the glass bottle any day. I don't like the feel of the PET bottle. But what I don't like is that people are picking the others and paying more for the glass or the aluminium, not because of that, but because not because they wanted it, but because they were lied to. That's what rubs me the wrong way as a scientist. We shouldn't have people paying extra to make the environment worse because they were told lies. That's what fuels my my crusade against this misinformation.
Yeah, it's fair. Perhaps just because it's come up a couple times already, and I already knew that the Great Pacific Garbage Patch wasn't a true island of garbage out in the Pacific. I wasn't. Right. It's perhaps I'll try to summarize what it is, and then you kind of expand and correct. So the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is basically, it's due to oceanography is the reason why it even exists. That's not to say that we wouldn't have lots of plastic in the ocean. It's just it gets concentrated due to our ocean currents and a big circular dryer out in the Pacific Ocean. Now, that particular patch or area, although it collects it, it has a higher concentration of it. It's if you're looking for it when you're driving through it, you will find stuff. If you are not looking for it, you may not see a single thing, is kind of the way I look at it. And there is a lot out there, but it's just, it comes down to concentration.
Yeah, that's perfectly put. So they do studies on this. We have 15 years of data on it. So the problem is that every green group and every government says that there's 10 or 12 million tons of plastic going into the ocean. They repeat this thing again and again. And what they don't understand was that was a guess made by Jenna Jambeck without a single shred of evidence. She literally said, let's take all the waste within 50 kilometers of the ocean, so 35 miles, anywhere in the world, and imagine that half of it jumps in the ocean. How much would it be? Oh, 10 million tons of plastic. She had no evidence for it. She literally just made it up. And yet every green group has a big 10 million tons are going to the ocean, donate now. The governments are flying around having emergency meetings talking about this 10 million tons that was never there. They've spent 50 years towing nets up and down in the ocean looking for this 50 million, these millions of tons, and they just can't find it. And it's not like one group. We got 50 years of data. And just to give you an idea how big an exaggeration that is, the best estimate is 6,000 tons if you look at all the studies that have been done. And I'm not saying that we should be putting 6,000 tons of plastic in the ocean. What I am saying is we shouldn't be lying and saying it's millions of tons when it isn't. And I mean, one ship, they've done this one experiment for 50 years, so it's extremely interesting because it's the longest experiment ever done. And they had to sail 100,000 miles towing a net to find one piece of plastic bag. That's four times around planet Earth. And yet every day we see the BBC or the Ellen MacArthur Fund or the World Wildlife Fund has a picture of a turtle with a bag around its neck. Did that turtle really sail? Did it really swim four times around the Earth and then try and loop a bag around its neck? I mean, this every picture you've ever seen of that is photoshopped. It's just a lie. I even called the BBC out on their lie the other day and they updated their article and said, sorry, that was a misleading image. So,
I'm sure you could. I mean, what's the phrase? A million monkeys on a million typewriters will eventually write Shakespeare's great works. So right. I don't know. I don't necessarily disbelieve that those pictures can exist in reality. I've seen my cat get stuck in a bag. So I definitely know it can happen, but point taken that it's very rare that something like that actually does happen.
Yeah.
But there's one thing that I wanted to kind of perhaps quickly poke at, because like I said, we're on the same footing here. No, we're not. But I do, like, maybe in the last maybe 5 or 10 years, we're starting to really get a good idea starting. Let's use the word starting, because I'm not sure some of the environmental baseline data really existed beyond that, of concentrations, particularly of smaller particles in both water and land and air. They are increasing. That data seems to be pretty clear. I'm not suggesting it's at a real, doomsday issue at the moment or anything like that, but do we have enough information to be able to say what kind of effects that's going to have on the ecology if we don't start changing those trends?
Yeah, we do have the data. The funny thing is that people think that this microplastics thing is a new, unstudied threat. And that's because they haven't read the science. We have 50 years of studies on microplastics. We have 2,000 studies, and they're non-toxic. So just to give you an idea, the amount of so particles can be dangerous. About 8 million people die a year of too much particles and unsafe air. So that can be a thing. But if you look at the plastic component of that, it's 0.001% of dust we ingest, and it's non-toxic. And what do I mean by non-toxic? It means less toxic than table salt. It's less toxic than caffeine. You could eat, literally, this is experiments done on mice, you could literally eat a coffee cup full of plastic pellets every day for months and nothing happens. I even read a paper last week where they fed 25% of the food to rats was PTFE, you know, from Teflon pans. They fed them 25% PTFE just to make them feel full and lose weight. And so this is the ideal diet material. It's so non-toxic, it's so safe, it's so inert. I'm not suggesting anyone does that, but that is how safe polyethylene, polypropylene, PET, PTFE, PVC, they've all been tested for decades. And that's why the FDA and regulatory bodies all around the earth allow us to eat, you know, our food from them, because they are that safe. So this, and here's the crazy thing, right? Every other part of dust, we call it dust. Right. These environmental groups have invented a word, microplastics, to take a tiny fraction of dust and suddenly make it sound exciting and dangerous. Right. We don't talk about micro wood or micro glass. And here's the or micro metal. Look, do a Google search. There's not a single hit for any of those things. And here's the irony of it. If you breathe in sawdust, you die. You can die of cancer. It's a carcinogen. It's a proven danger, right? It's the same with quartz, which comes from the land. There are studies where farmers are tilling the fields and they're breathing so much rock that they can get cancer from it. So, you know.
To be fair, that's not really where I was going with that question. I was
okay, but anyway, my point is it's not a new unrecognized threat. We have thousands of studies and there is no threat. Ingestion is very low and they're non-toxic and they're not increasing because we've done studies on that too, because they degrade. People think that these plastic particles don't degrade and they accumulate, and that's not true. They do degrade and they do biodegrade as well.
Okay. I'm going to go back before I go forward, because you just brought up something that I want to look at. But first, I was more trying to go at the ecology side as opposed to human health side. So one of the things that I did look up or came across that was one of the few surprising things, I should say, that I found, because I wasn't really thinking about it, was showing that microplastics in the water column can affect how much CO2 is being exchanged through that water column.
Okay.
And that was more to do with the ecology of it, not the plastics itself. The plastics were changing the behavior of different organisms in the sense that they would attach themselves to the plastic and then be removed from the water column as they sunk. Keep in mind, this is not my specialty. So no. I was kind of like looking at that and went, maybe there's more nuance here than I was aware of.
There is a lot of nuance. So I've got a study right in front of me now. Let me put it. I've got 300 slides in front of me now because I'm, as you are, a scientist who likes to quote things that are correct. So here we are. Here's a study on microplastics in the ocean. I'm going to quote you now. We concluded an ecological risk assessment of microplastics in the global ocean by comparing the thresholds of biological effects with probability of exposure to these concentrations. Levels of microplastics, blah, 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 are so low that it's just negligible. There's negligible global risk. That's literally a quote from the study, because amounts are hundreds or thousands of times lower than would be needed to have any effect whatsoever. So this is the problem with many of these studies. What they do is they take a million times too much plastic. That's what they typically do in these studies that look like they're something scary. They take a million times more than is really in the environment, and then they compare it to pure distilled water. What you really need to do is you need to take a realistic amount of plastic and compare it to all of the other particles in the ocean. And when you do that, you just find out it's negligible. There's study after study after study showing that there's just not enough there to cause any harm to anything because it's non-toxic. So there are certainly studies showing a problem, but all of those studies have been discredited, not just by me, but by other scientists pointing out that using a million times too much, using a type of particle that doesn't exist in the environment, you know, not using a proper control by comparing it to other particles. Sure. Yeah, they all end up every single. Let me put it this way. I've read 500 studies. I've never seen a single one that showed a credible harm from microplastics.
Is that I take your point on the toxicity, and you've noticed I haven't gone there for good reason, because, I mean, like you said, there's been certain chemicals removed from plastic that had toxic effects, but they wasn't the plastic themselves. It was like the additives to them. So there's that. But do we really have an idea? Like, we also know, I think in Japan, there was an organism found, a bacteria that actually evolved to eat plastic. Mm-hmm. So there are things that are changing because of our plastic waste in the environment. And we do, like, I'm not sure exactly where I'm going here, because now I'm off script.
No, that's all right.
But
all
right.
If you're I like it that you're curious. I mean, these are great questions. I mean, this, maybe the simplest way to put it is that people think we don't have the science. And I put up a LinkedIn post just this week listing every question I've ever heard about microplastics. What kind of plastics are they? How much are there? Does it affect health? Does it affect my dog and cat? I mean, literally the answer to every question I've ever heard is answered in the science, peer-reviewed science, not from the plastics industry. So, yeah, it's amazing. People are making millions and millions of dollars scaring people over something that's not even true. For example, there's just today, Washington Post had a thing about microplastics in the brain. This study has literally been disproven again and again and again. So they did a study using a technique called pyrolysis GC mass spec. That's where you take a sample, you more or less burn it, right? You heat it to really high temperatures and the molecules fall to pieces. Then you measure those pieces and say, oh, I wonder what that molecule could have been, right? So you're guessing somehow. And what they've proven is, other scientists have said, you cannot use that method for detecting plastic in the brain because it detects fat and says, oh, this might be plastic. So other scientists have literally said, don't use this method. It doesn't work. And this story has been going around and around the world multiple times on Washington Post, New York Times, all around the world, again and again and again. And no matter how many scientists point out that it's nonsense, they just keep going because they're selling advertising dollars. You know, the more extreme and ridiculous the claim is, the more advertising clicks you can get with it. So I just wrote to the editor of the Washington Post today saying, please stop posting this nonsense. And I, you know, imploring them and sending them study after study, proving that it's just fiction.
Is this the same? I think I read maybe this morning, and not the Washington Post. That was the one that they made a claim that we have a 50% increase in the brain due to plastics over since 2014 or something like that.
Yeah, it's complete nonsense.
Yeah. Was that the study?
Yeah, I was the first to debunk it more than a year ago. I have a whole webpage on it. And it's not just me. Like I said, there's other scientists saying this is just awful, awful, invalid nonsense. But of course, that doesn't sell. And that's the trouble. I'm out here telling the truth for free, right? And that's just not a good idea. The truth isn't exciting, and it's not profitable either. Telling lies for money is way more interesting. And that's why 90% of people have sold out and are doing just that, because that is profitable and that's exciting and that makes you famous. Telling the truth for free doesn't help you in any way. In fact, yeah, it's taking money away from my paid job, which is what puts my kid through college.
So I don't make any money on the podcast. I can't imagine when that'll actually happen. I mean, sure, so you get some money back, but after you pay for all the individual subscriptions and equipment and hosting, ain't gonna happen. I do this for fun. So similar but different. I would imagine, though, you can use the fact that you are out here as a communicator to also help in your consulting business, right?
Well, the trouble with that is my consulting is about making better materials. I'm a formulator. I'm like a cook. My wife likes to say that I'm a chef for plastics. I know what additives should go in there, how to make it better, how to make it last longer. It does degrade. They spend $5 billion a year on additives to make plastics not degrade quickly. Right. So that's another lie. So that's what I do as a living. And unfortunately, that is so different to what I'm doing now with you as a hobby, that it doesn't really synergize well. It's a totally different. In fact, it confuses people. Now I'm more famous for this unpaid work than I am for my actual job. So that's not a great strategical move on my part.
Well, maybe one of these days you can write a different type of book and be all about the conversations you've had and maybe make money off of that one.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, as I said, people always assume they're like always on a podcast to give away his, you know, to sell his book, and here it is, but it's for free in multiple languages.
Yeah, it's for free. I was able to download it. And my first one is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my first two books, the first one was about innovation and how big companies suck at it and how to improve.
I don't think I read that one.
Innovation.
I just read the two on plastic. Okay, but the only thing, maybe I'll tie two different pieces together and one of the podcasts I heard you on, one of the first things that you decided to step out and say was like, I'm not a shill for big plastic. And I was like, what?
People say that all the time. They're like, you're getting paid to say this. And I'm like, I find it shocking that people are that arrogant and outright shameful that, like, literally, like, imagine a top scientist. I mean, I'm, you know, you can check my credentials. I'm well respected. I'm a fellow of this and that, right? I'm not a clown. I spent 5,000 years, 1,000 hours a year for 5 years of my life to read the science, repeat it verbatim, have it checked by professors around the world. And then people have the audacity to say that I do it all unpaid. And then they have the audacity to say that I'm a shill. I'm like, how big is your ego that you've not read a single study? You're absolutely clueless. You're going off headlines from, you know, from newspaper articles. You've never, you didn't actually genuinely care, right? Imagine they'd actually done their homework and came at me and said, oh, look, here's some evidence, whatever. That I can respect. But these people who've not put in 10 seconds of actual work and have the audacity to question the credibility of an unpaid scientist. I mean, that's the delusional world we're living in right now, where it's just beyond belief.
Interesting. So it is something that you've had to deal with so often that sometimes you feel like you need to step up and say it right from the get-go, as you'd be like, look.
Yeah, because and that's the thing. People will say it was a lot worse in the beginning. Now most people have checked out what I've been saying, and you know, and they realize that it checks out and it's all real. And you can check some of my followers on LinkedIn. I mean, some of them are real influential people. I've been on Jordan Harbinger's show, and he's a real big heavy hitter in the podcast space, and credit to him. So, but some people every week, basically, somebody will say, "Oh, you're just a plastics guy," and this and that and the other, and they haven't been to the website. I'm like, it literally says it discloses my sources of funding, that it's not for this. I've done all the work for free. The professors are working for free. We have a toxicologist working for free. And, you know, all of this stuff, it's, and the 100% of the money from my not have a nonprofit, right? And the goal of that is, you've probably checked it out, it's called the Plastics Research Council, where we have top scientists working without a single penny of money, sharing science verbatim with links, as you know. And the only point of the money is to basically hire a bigger megaphone, because we have the science. We've done all that for free. We've done all the checking, and we've done all of the fact finding for free, unpaid. But we need PR, because we're up against companies which have millions and millions and millions of dollars just telling outright lies. And there's no way to fight that unless we've got professional PR people taking our scientific message and doing what you just said, taking that dry scientific message and trying to get it out there to actual media people who will listen to the truth. So all of that funding goes, 100% of it goes external, like 1% to bank fees and the other 99% to external PR people. So and yet they'll still come at you and say, well, it's the Plastics Research Council, it must be a bunch of shills. And I find it insulting. These people should almost be prosecuted for slander, for taking people who are working out of the goodness of their heart to do something for humanity and then criticizing them for it. It really is shameful, but people don't have shame anymore.
Maybe now's a good time for you to explain a little bit how that NGO came about, but I will preface it just with, I do know there's a number of think tanks that are out there, not the same as what you're doing at all. Please don't make, but a lot of people make the association in their head, right? Yeah. So if you want to take, so me being Canadian and obviously would be left wing in the States, the Heritage Foundation, for instance, would be an NGO which has academic thought, and I'm using quotation marks here, I'm on the podcast. So those are like an example of what people might instantaneously associate with something like that. It doesn't mean it's the same thing. Oh my gosh, they're not even close to the same thing. Yeah. You can have a think tank that is all science-based and does phenomenal work. You can disagree with them, but at least they're providing you the data and everything else. And then you have the other side of the picture, which are crazy. And I think a lot of the public is associating the crazy with all the rest that are actually doing really good work.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things to say there. One is people get this idea about who's paying. I use the who's paying question as well, but people use it wrongly. So what I do is, let's say you've read 5,000 studies, you read some study and you read it, and you know this in your field, right? You read some study and you go, this is just nonsense. How can it be that wrong? right? And then you think, oh, I wonder who paid for it. And you go to the end of the study and go, oh, Michael Bloomberg paid for it, right? Because he's against fossil fuel and plastics. And that's not an accusation. That's on public record, right? He said that. So, and then you think, oh, well, now it makes sense, right? This thing, which is completely against the rest of the whole of scientific community, and it's just full of nonsense, may be that way because it was paid for. Another one is there's an organization called Mindaroo, founded and funded by iron and steel billionaires in Australia called the Foresters or something like that, right? So they literally funded a nonprofit which just goes out and it points the finger at a competing industry, right? Because the iron and steel industry is way worse than the plastic industry.
You're saying the same thing I was, but with better examples. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that I'm against. I'm against people saying things which are just clearly wrong. And then you go and check the funding and go, well, that's why it's wrong, because presumably because they were funded to say things. And that's the other thing. These other NGOs, they're on salary, these people. We're working without a single penny of salary. So then you've got to say, well, where's your incentive to jeopardize your scientific credibility, right? You would just be exposed and you'd just be called out as a charlatan, right, or a fraud if you were out there for 5 years sharing stuff that wasn't true and unpaid. And why would you do it? What's your incentive for if you're being paid a couple hundred grand a year, right, like certain people are, to tell lies? I can kind of get it, like maybe they've got gambling problems, maybe they've got no alternative than to tell lies for money. There's kind of a thing. But when you're literally out there doing it for free, then it's really hard to accept somebody trying to criticize you for it as well when they haven't.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's fair. So one of the things that I thought maybe was missing from your books and stuff was the policy side of things. Like, you dance around it, you do address it, but like you're very clear, plastic waste of any sort, when it's too much that it starts to accumulate in the environment, is bad. It doesn't really matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's plastic or carbon or whatever. When it starts to accumulate, it starts to affect things, even if it is very small effect, even if it's the best of the worst, as you rephrased it earlier.
Right.
And you've also mentioned that these lies about, or at the very least, things that are untrue, I don't want to necessarily call them lies, because if you believe it and it's wrong, it's just an untruth, of recycling, like, we need to be better at it, right? We need to get better at recycling and reducing plastic waste. Is there like real mechanisms that we should be looking at?
Right. Well, there's a couple things to unpack. So the first one is, you're right, I did avoid policy because I hate politics. I think I'm a scientist. I care about facts, and that's basically the opposite of being a politician. So I specifically try not to read the policy stuff. People ask me, what do you think of this policy here or there or whatever? I try to avoid it because I just think it's a big mess. And there's so many disingenuous actors in that space that I get an allergic reaction. So that's one thing. On the other hand, people have started coming to me. So recently, some attorneys general in the US were planning to sue the plastics industry, I heard. And so I was asked to come in and show them the science. And then they saw the science and said, oh, that would be a really bad idea. Why would you sue the industry that is 0.5% of materials and has least impact 9 times out of 10? That doesn't make logical sense. So they abandon it. So I am being pulled into the policy thing, and I'm actually enjoying it more than I thought I would, because I just do the education part. Like, I just go in and say, look, here are the facts. I don't recommend policies, right? I just say, here are the facts. Now you go off and make policy based on what's actually true. And that's worked out great in every time I've done it so far. So it's felt kind of rewarding. When it comes to waste, you're right, we do make too much stuff, but it's not the crisis people think. The problem is not waste, the problem is mismanaged waste. So there's a calculation in the book, and I've got to give, I think it was Stossel, John Stossel had a podcast, and he brought this topic up. If you were to take 1,000 years of US waste and landfill it, it would take 0.2% of America's land space. So we're not running out of space to bury stuff, right? The problem is when we mismanage it, when we like have an open landfill and it blows away, or the elephants get in and eat it, and all that kind of nonsense. So waste itself doesn't seem to be a problem. We've got the Romans buried it, and we can too, or we can burn it, or we can do other things with it. It's not the problem that people think. And when it comes to recycling, which is the last thing you said, plastic is the lowest impact solution usually, even without recycling. So there's too much focus on recycling right now. And don't get me wrong, recycling takes the thing that has lowest impact and further reduces it by 70 or 80%. So you take your plastic, you wash it, you grind it up, you melt it, you make a new part. That is regular mechanical recycling done with equipment everybody has all around the world. It's green, it's safe, it's cheap, and it makes sense. It's not easy. It's not that easy to do profitably. And that's so companies go out of business. All that. So people say plastic recycling is a scam or whatever. And it isn't. It's just it's harder to do profitably. And there's a fundamental reason for that, which you'll find fascinating. To make a kilo of gold, you need to generate 20,000 kilos of CO2. To make a kilo of plastic, you need to generate like 1 or 2 kilos of CO2. So gold is really valuable, really expensive, and definitely worth recycling. Plastic is really low impact, really cheap, and barely worth recycling from an economic point of view. So this is basically a cheat the aluminium industry is perpetrating on us. They're telling us, go and use an aluminium can because at the end of life, it's got so much energy embodied in it, and it's worth so much. I'm like, yeah, of course it's worth so much. It was a worse solution. It used more energy. It took more cost and it's worth more at the end of the life. And the analogy I like to use is this. Imagine I told you, don't buy a Fiat car, go and buy a Ferrari because it will have a higher trade-in value. And that is the same exact thing that the aluminium industry and the glass industry are trying to perpetrate on us. They're trying to say, go and use this worse, more expensive solution because at the end of life, it will have so much more value. Of course, it will have more value, just like a lump of gold would. Nobody throws away gold. But you see what I mean? This is a false way of thinking. We should use whatever option has the least impact and then recycle that.
For sure. And maybe this is where I get a little confused by the fact that you danced around the policy side of things, not because I understand not wanting to get into the politics of it all, but maybe because I come from in volcanology where we deal with natural hazards, that policy interaction is always kind of there. You're always trying to educate the policymakers on what's yes. happening at the volcano, and then you can suggest things, but fundamentally the decision rests with them, right? So,
right.
So that's
where I am now. And that's new since the book. So since the book, I've got more involved in that. You're exactly right. I did avoid it. I don't want to be involved in it. But if I'm the only source of credible information who can provide peer-reviewed science, then I have an obligation to educate those people when I'm asked to.
Right. So one example is here in British Columbia, and it changes from province to province, state to state. If you're in the United States, our plastic bottles cost the same amount to return, they have the same value as the glass bottle. It has the same value as the aluminum can.
Oh.
Everything is 5 cents. Like okay. You get a nickel back. There's a reason why you don't find many plastic bottles around because everyone collects them. They're all returned. Yeah. They put a price on plastic bags. And I'm not saying this was the right play. So you can't easily get plastic bags at checkout. And paper costs you money if you want it at checkout here.
Yeah.
It actually costs you 25 cents to get a paper bag. So now almost everybody takes reusable bags. Like it's a complete shift here in Vancouver, a usage shift. Okay. So I can see that policy does work when population buys in. I also read some papers where they banned plastic in some third world countries, and that just created more mess because they started like bringing in plastic from other places to like right. fill the void. And you're like, oh my goodness, this is an example where it doesn't work. But there does seem to be a lot more space in the policy realm to be able to make real changes, both to reduce our carbon footprint because we're using the material that is lighter, etc., as well as like having managing or mismanaging less waste.
Yeah. Well, here's the problem with policy. So we've allowed the consumers to be lied to for 10 years. The plastics industry stood by, their trade association stood by, and now everyone believes the lies. So if you look at a recent McKinsey report and you ask people what's greenest, they say glass, which is just wrong. That is scientifically wrong. And then they say the second best is paper, which is scientifically wrong. And the third best is metal, which is wrong. So they see plastic, the greenest solution and the cheapest option, as being the worst for the environment, which is wrong. And the trouble with that is that they've done studies of supermarket executives. They say, oh, yeah, we know that the alternatives to plastics increase harm, but our customers want it, so we have to sell it to them. It's the same with politicians. What do you think they're going to do? If the customer thinks that plastic is the worst, they're going to ban plastic bags, even though 30 studies show that it's the lowest impact solution. Or they're going to tax it, because why wouldn't a politician tax whatever? They'll tax anything. They'll tax you for getting up in the morning if they could. So that's the problem, that at the moment we're enacting policies and selling alternatives which make things worse and cost more. And you're right. Look at New Jersey. They banned plastic bags. And then 2 years later, they looked back and saw what happened. You know what happened? exponentially more greenhouse gas, which is what every life cycle study predicted, and increased sales of plastic, because when you reuse a grocery bag, they're very thin. You can use that as a trash can liner. When you ban those bags, you have to go and buy a 5 times thicker trash can liner made of plastic. So you increase. So if the plastics industry was smart, they'd be out there pushing for plastic bag bans so they can sell more plastic. But that's not what I'm advocating. I'm advocating that we do what makes sense based on science.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see how the plastic bag ban in Canada has really changed things. I looked, I couldn't find any data, enough data on it to really dig into.
So the life cycle studies do show that the reusable bag, plastic bag, is greener if you reuse it enough time.
I wonder if people are reusing it enough. That's what I mean. Like, I didn't find the data one way or the other to figure that out. Because, yeah, I mean, if you reuse something long enough, you're going to offset its material cost, essentially.
That's exactly right. People always ask, why don't you do reusables? And the problem is, reusables reduce impact about half the time and increase it the other half, because a reusable has to use more material to be more durable, and so you have to reuse it enough times to break even and then reduce impact. And as you just said, there's very little evidence in some cases that that's really happening. And in fact, in some cases you see pictures of people with a closet full of plastic bags that are supposed to be reusable, but they forgot to take it. Or in my case, I've got those takeaway from the Asian, you know, restaurant. I've got these takeaway little black things with a clear top, and I've got a whole cupboard full of those, which I can't even shut the door. I'm not even exaggerating. There's so much more plastic being sold into those reusable things, and I wonder if it's helping anyone. So yeah, we need more policy based on sense, and then people have to go and check to make sure it's working afterwards.
Yeah, that's where I'm wondering about my own country, is like, where's the follow-up? Something that's probably come up that you've done multiple times is the plastic Christmas tree. Now, how many times you have to reuse the plastic Christmas tree before it works better than the one you buy off the Christmas tree farm? And I think it was something like 10 years or something.
Is it? Yeah, I think I saw something on that. I haven't looked into it in detail. The funny thing is, the greenest straw is no straw. I don't know how low intelligence you need to be to work out that the greenest option is, and cheapest, is just to say no to the straw. I mean, I'm not asking miracles here. I mean, if you got more than intelligence of a cat, you can probably work that out.
I had a funny thing when I was growing up, you know, in those informative years when you first hit university, and somebody says to me, yeah, men don't take straws in their drinks. And I was like, what? Okay, sure, I won't take a straw, and so now I don't. But it has nothing to do with being green. It's just something that I no longer do because I was told once.
Wow. I don't know. Real men don't eat quiche. That's one that I heard once. I don't know where people make this stuff up from.
But I love quiche.
Yeah, I know, me too.
It's got cheese.
Yeah,
anyway.
Real people eat what they want to because they want it, not because of what anyone else thinks. That's part of what I'm doing here. I don't care what people think. What I'm saying is unpopular, but it's true, and I don't give a flying F, flying whatever, a monkeys or whatever you want to say. If you're doing what's right, do it. Don't be a sheep. Don't follow. Don't just go along with the crowd. Don't do what you think you should do because your neighbor thinks it. Do what's true. You know, do what's true, do what's right, and provide evidence to prove it. And hopefully one day the pendulum will swing and people will care about facts again sometime.
I will only add that I think we skipped a fair bit of nuance, and that's partly my fault because I don't have the background to be able to poke at it too much, to even ask the right questions, because it's a huge, broad topic for sure. But yeah, plastic is here to stay. That's the way it's going to be. We need it.
The problem with it is not perceived as natural, right? We're so used to paper, even though it's not natural. Concrete's not natural. But all of these things somehow feel like part of the natural world, and we don't react on it the same way as we do as things that look so clearly synthetic.
All right. Well, I think we're pretty much nearing the end here, which means we pivot from something that was potentially a little dark to something that's humorous, unless it's dark humor, but that's on you. I have no idea what kind of joke you're going to tell, because the traditional last question is here.
Yes.
Tell us a science joke, hopefully your favorite.
I did spend ages looking for science jokes. I found one that's funny, and then I made up a limerick. So here's a limerick. A scientist cloned his feet, and though the work was really neat, they ran down the hall and climbed up the wall, then moonwalked their way down the street.
There, that's the first poem we've had on the pod.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. The other one's a chemist joke, so I think only a small part of the audience will get it. But
chemistry jokes are only funny periodically. It's all right.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, you set me up.
Yeah, I did. Thanks for having me on the show. Thanks for caring about evidence, and thanks for scratching the surface and seeing what's really going on underneath. I really respect that.
Awesome. Thank you for being here.
So there's the discussion. If you've been following along, there's a good chance that you're at least annoyed with me. I was unable to get my guest to really address or tackle the nuance. The issues with plastic inundating our environment and the trade-offs. It's always a choice. There's no doubt when it comes to the global supply chains and the way material moves around the world, plastic is generally better for carbon offsets. It's lighter, easier to move, and it doesn't really produce a whole lot of carbon to recycle. However, there's a lot of things we just don't really know. Well, it's true, plastic is chemically inert, at least pretty close. That just means picking up the effect is difficult. It doesn't mean it's zero. What concentration does it become harmful? Remember, everything can be deadly. I had a chemistry professor in first year that would say, the poison's in the dose. You can drink enough water and cause damage. You can kill yourself by drinking too much water. It is exceedingly difficult, but it does happen. What is the concentration of plastic, macro or micro, where problems begin to occur? This episode had no discussion on that other than basically a hand wave to say the majority of papers showing problems have a concentration that is higher than natural levels. Exposure to something harmful is also based on time. Let's give a much more toxic example. Lead, covered in season one. Being exposed to lead, even a small amount, is always bad. However, the effect of being exposed once, in one event, is very different than a continual exposure. When it's continual, it'll build up in the body, just like microplastics. And then there's macroplastics, which is in its own discussion. Yeah, I've seen wildlife like ducks get caught in plastic rings and bags myself. This exists. How prevalent is it? I have no idea. The point of this end bit today is to address that I didn't do a great job in this interview, at least in my own opinion, because I was unable to get my guest to address some of the nuance. Then again, I don't believe my guest, Dr. Chris Darnett, was really willing to go there, and I get it. There's a lot of guesswork or back-of-the-envelope calculations with huge assumptions floating around media. It's not really science-based, and it's become very political. And when you get right down to it, a lot of those statements are just untrue. And he feels the industry has been unfairly vilified, and the whole thing is just part of lies when plastic can be part of many solutions. And it's just clear that modern life requires plastic. That inability to go there, that's on me. And I feel it was a failure. Perhaps I'll need to revisit this discussion in the future. Maybe it'll age poorly. Maybe it'll age well, and it's just a snapshot in my own learning. I'm glad I did this interview regardless. I was unaware that there was so much political force out there against plastic. I always just understood there was trade-offs. It's a good thing and a bad thing at the same time. I definitely missed the mark here, and with respect to the nuance, being able to discuss plastic and its effects on the environment. However, it is still true that plastic is not bad per se. It's all about trade-offs, and often it is the right material for the task. Hopefully, all of you people out there on the internet listening can give me some feedback, how I did, or how poorly I did. Maybe hate mail, or maybe just a, that's interesting. Not sure I agree. Regardless, that was the episode here on Whimsical Wavelengths. Next episode deviates back to something a little bit more comforting, to paleontology. In 2 weeks, I'll see you then.
In a world so chaotic, so misbehaved, echoes of melodies remind us it's always colors weave stories painting the sky, swaying to rhythms as the galaxies fly by. Deep in our bones.
see.